Coming up, Fred DeSam Lazaro from Cambodia. Can factories pay garment workers a living wage and at the same time keep costs low enough to stay in business?
At the core is that this concept of the human dignity of the person.
And Lucky Severson on helping veterans continue their mission here at home.
Every single one of them told me that they wanted to find a way to continue to serve.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. 6 weeks after the Boston Marathon bombing, Muslim leaders are renewing calls for more coordinated efforts to combat online radicalization. The suspects in the bombing were apparently influenced by online interactions. At a Washington briefing, Boston Imam Suhaib Webb acknowledged that some local Muslims were aware of Tamerlan Tsarnaev's extreme views. He said Islamic leaders must be more proactive in addressing extremism, but he added they must be able to do that without fear of heightened scrutiny from law enforcement.
Imams and scholars within the community need to be given some leeway to engage this problem. The fact that the Tsarnaev brother wasn't able to sit down with an imam and go through counseling, I think, is a problem on our community's fault, our side of the fence. We need to be able to, I need to be able to sit down with someone and not worry about being subpoenaed or held as a material witness.
Meanwhile, the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, is calling for an independent investigation after law enforcement officials shot a Tsarnaev acquaintance during an interview in Florida this week. There were conflicting reports over whether the man, who was Muslim, was armed, but the government said he had become violent. CARE wants a civil rights review. Faith-based groups pledged to continue their massive mobilization to help victims of last week's deadly tornado in Moore, Oklahoma, which destroyed some 13,000 homes and killed 24 people. Numerous religious groups are helping with cleanup and providing supplies and food. The Evangelical Samaritan's Purse says it has dispatched about 1,000 volunteers to Moore and nearly that many to neighboring Shawnee. Catholic sisters who are part of the Nuns on the Bus project launched a new effort this week to push for immigration reform. The bus of nuns will travel 6,500 miles, stopping in 15 states over the next 3 weeks. They're urging Congress to pass a comprehensive overhaul of the nation's immigration policies.
Our future is in the promise that immigration reform provides. Because with immigration reform, we can get just wages. We can improve working conditions. We can bring people out of the shadows.
A new Gallup poll found that 77% of Americans think religion's influence on the nation is decreasing. That's the highest percentage since the question was first asked in 1957. But 75% say an increase in the number of religious Americans would be positive for society. In Iraq, growing concerns over the steep escalation of sectarian violence. More than 100 people died this week in a series of back-and-forth bombings in Sunni and Shiite neighborhoods. Several mosques have also been destroyed. According to the UN, at least 500 people were killed in May. In April, 700 were killed, making that the deadliest month since 2008. Sectarian violence also continued in Myanmar between Buddhists and the country's Muslim minority. More than 1,000 Muslims sought refuge in a Buddhist monastery after a mob burned down parts of a Muslim neighborhood. The violence was sparked by a local dispute between a Muslim man and a Buddhist woman. The factory collapse in Bangladesh last month, which killed more than 1,000 people, highlighted the terrible conditions for many workers who make clothing for the West. Indeed, if you buy low-cost clothes at almost any U.S. store, chances are good they were made in Asia or South America, where labor costs are cheaper. Fred de Sam Lazro looked at the situation for garment workers in Cambodia and an old ethical dilemma. Can factories pay workers a living wage and at the same time keep costs low enough to stay in business?
Back in the 1990s, Cambodia, impoverished and rebuilding after its genocidal Khmer Rouge years, took steps to give its new garment industry a competitive leg up. It agreed to a system of fair labor standards with a minimum wage rule, a limit to working hours, unions to represent workers, and freedom of expression. All would be open to international inspection. Today, there are perhaps 400,000 garment workers in more than 300 factories in and near the capital, Phnom Penh. They are subcontractors to brand names and retailers in Europe and America.
Beginning from scratch less than two decades ago, Cambodia's garment industry has grown into the largest export earner for this country. $3 out of $4 that come into Cambodia come from the garment factories.
The key question is how much all of this has benefited workers, almost all of whom are female. Many factories have been plagued by labor unrest. Occasionally, it's been violent. There have been frequent reports of faintings on factory floors. The unions cite unhealthy conditions and workers weak from malnourishment.
Workers have very low salaries, only $61 per month. You cannot afford to live on that day to day. It's legalized slavery.
Che introduced us to these workers. Like most of their colleagues, they are young rural migrants living in tight shared quarters, supporting extended families back home. Chem Savet supports a farm family in a rural province 60 miles away, including her husband, her parents, and two-year-old daughter.
I can only see her once a month. When I go home, she really misses me, so she hugs me, especially when I must leave only one day later.
The standard six-day, 48-hour week, plus overtime, leaves little time for travel to see family. Factory managers aren't sympathetic during family emergencies, they complained, and many employees are on temporary instead of permanent employment contracts.
Previously, we saw a lot of strikes, but those haven't happened recently in our factory because there are a lot of newcomers.
The minimum wage, clearly, is not sufficient for workers to meet their basic needs. We're talking food, we're talking clothing.
David Schilling is with the New York-based Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. It's a shareholder activist group that wants to add a moral voice in global economic matters.
Whether you're talking about all the Abrahamic traditions, the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim traditions, at the core is that concept of the human dignity of the person. So you're taking that and then you're moving into the realities.
Ken Liu represents Cambodia's garment factory owners. He sees a very different reality for workers.
They're not whipped, you know, they're not chained. They come to work willingly.
He says most garment workers make more than the $61 minimum wage, closer to $90 a month, he says, higher with overtime. And that's more than policemen, teachers, or most civil servants, he adds.
We have to put things in context. The per capita GDP of Cambodia for last year, as announced by the World Bank, was 908. So the average garment factory worker earns 40% more than national per capita GDP. If you use that as a gauge, I think any worker in America would be glad to get 40% more than national per capita GDP.
Cambodia's Minister of Commerce says factory owners have little wiggle room because they are no more than contract tailors.
They do not own the fabric, they do not own the brand, they just import the fabric, cut, sew, pack, and then sell.
Prasidh could impose higher wages in the factories, most of which are owned by investors from China, Taiwan, Korea, and Malaysia. But, he says, that would be suicidal.
There is a lot of demonstration to ask for living condition, to ask to increase the minimum wage. And what happened? The investor just packed the sewing machine and they go home.
Or they go to another country.
They go to another country. So we have to compare that our price with Bangladesh, we have to compare our price with Pakistan or India, you know, or even with China.
San Francisco-based Gap is the largest buyer of garments made in Cambodia. It also buys from dozens of other developing nations. Spokeswoman Bobby Silton says Gap, which owns the Old Navy and Banana Republic chains as well, has no plans to leave Cambodia.
We have very long-standing relationships with many of the vendors in Cambodia. It's been one of our top 10 sourcing countries for the last 10 years. So we are very committed to being there. And we think that the labor standards that they have put in place is one of the reasons why we continue to stay.
Ken Liu says buyers may talk up the labor standards, but in 2008, when the global recession began, many, including Gap, cut back in Cambodia. At the same time, he says, Bangladesh, with lower pay and labor standards, saw no drop in business.
It just confirms our knowledge that indeed and compliance or labor standards is the icing on the cake. Price is the cake.
It is a race to the bottom. And Cambodia, to survive, we have to create something special.
Jill Tucker says Cambodia does have a special competitive advantage since buyers want to be associated with ethical labor standards. Tucker heads an agency supported by the UN and the U.S. government that conducts factory inspections for compliance with the labor standards.
In the olden days, by that I mean maybe 10 years ago, it was more of a cat and mouse game than it is now. And the really smart producers, I think, realize that, you know, you need to treat your workers well to retain your workers, and that it's just not worth it to not treat your workers well.
She cites this factory, run by a Taiwan-based company, QMI, as a good example. There's plenty of air and light, and managers say good labor relations. All 10,000 of QMI's workers are on permanent contracts, and wages here range from $90 to as much as $150 a month. That's still below what unions say is adequate, but Tucker says demands for higher wages, however justified, are a tough sell, given realities in the U.S., the biggest market.
I really wonder if American consumers are willing to pay significantly more for their apparel.
Really?
Yeah. The cost of apparel has only dropped over the past decade. None of us are paying more for our garments than we were 10 years ago.
We do need to think about what consumers are willing to pay, where we can source these goods to achieve, you know, get the math to work for everyone. From a macro standpoint, I think it's a very complex issue.
Gap Silton isn't sure if consumers would pay more for ethically produced garments. The Interfaith Center Shilling says retailers like Gap, pressured by competitors and Wall Street investors, aren't likely to ask them to do so. More likely, he says, campaigns by activist groups should bring a greater awareness of worker rights issues, as they are now on environmental ones.
There's more and more advertising around, you know, sort of ecologically sound products. I think more and more that's going to happen within the social space as well.
That would bring greater awareness of the plight of workers in Cambodia and, more urgently, other nations that don't subscribe to fair labor standards. And Schilling says it could not happen fast enough. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro.
This past week, the nation paid tribute to members of the U.S. Armed Forces who died while in military service. For veterans returning from overseas, especially those who've been injured, many say one of the things they miss most is a sense of serving others, of being needed. Lucky Severson reports on one project that tries to help vets continue their mission here at home.
These are all vets from all branches of the service, Iraq and Afghanistan vets embarking on a new mission for themselves and their communities. Today, trading their military uniforms for a blue shirt.
I want you to stand up now if you believe that you have more to give and that you're an asset to your country.
This is an orientation session for a rapidly growing nonprofit program called The Mission Continues, which enlists veterans to serve their communities in over 37 states so far. It was founded in 2007 by Eric Greitens, a former Navy SEAL and commander of an Al-Qaeda targeting unit. The unit was hit by a truck bomb, and it was after visiting his injured comrades that Greitens got the idea for starting The Mission Continues.
And when you say to them, say, tell me, what do you want to do when you recover? Every single one of them said to me, I want to return to my unit. They all said, I want to return to my unit. Now, the reality was for a lot of those men and women is that they were not going to be able to return to their unit. I said, tell me if you can't go back to your unit right away, tell me what else you'd like to do. Every single one of them told me that they wanted to find a way to continue to serve.
Greitens had made a significant discovery about the dark space so many veterans find themselves in when they get home. It's not so much that they feel unwelcome, they feel unneeded.
I was depressed. I was doing a lot of self-pitying at the time. That's when I came across The Mission Continues.
Natasha Young was in the Marines for 12 years, a gunnery sergeant medically discharged a year ago with cancer and PTSD.
There was no shortage of organizations offering free items like movie tickets. That's not what I needed. I needed someone to say that, you know what, Staff Sergeant Young, you're still needed. You have valuable, tangible skills that you can still utilize in your community.
There are 72 vets in this group out of over 700 who applied. Getting accepted as a fellow is not easy. Spencer Kipton, the second in command of The Mission Continues, is a former Black Hawk helicopter pilot.
You have to be able to demonstrate that you're not done serving, that you have a particular passion to serve in the same way that you did when you raised your right hand and said you'd support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
The vets who are accepted are hooked up with local nonprofit organizations in their communities.
Whether that's mentoring low-income kids or building homes for the impoverished or training service animals for people with disabilities, you know, those are positive role models for those communities.
For their 6 months of volunteering, they receive a stipend of roughly $7,000 from The Mission Continues, which receives its funding from foundations and companies like Target, the Home Depot, and Southwest Airlines. On this day, before they return to their communities, they're bused to the Trinity River, south of the Dallas skyline, for a final group effort to clear brush and create an overlook along a newly opened trail. Eric Greiten says what we see here is an example of how military training can work in civilian life.
There's a tremendous set of skills and abilities which they bring back from their military service that they can now use here at home. They've all learned what it takes to work with a team and accomplish a mission. They're all used to being held accountable. They know what it takes to inspire people in difficult circumstances. They know that success doesn't come easy. So they bring back those skills and also those attitudes which they can apply in a civilian context.
You take a bunch of veterans and you put them on an objective. It's going to get done one way or another.
Robert Brown was discharged from the Marines in 2004. He was suffering from a traumatic brain injury and PTSD.
I was an RP, I was a religious program specialist, worked with the chaplain, so I worked with suicide guys. We had several attempts, and then...
You needed some help yourself.
Yeah.
What happens for a lot of veterans when they come home, especially when they get back to their community, is that they can go to a very tough and hard place. And they start to wonder, what's next for me? And they ask themselves, why did this happen to me?
I had no idea what I was going to do. It made me homeless. I had no money, nowhere to go. And then I finally had enough courage to go back home and hung out with family. But that wasn't working very good, you know. People's got their own family and kids. And
you know, when you're in the military, you're part of something that other men and women to your left and right are part of alongside with you. And it's a life. It's a family. So when you leave that, you know, very distinct environment, you know, a piece of you is missing.
This is the best I've felt. I've lost 73 pounds. I've still got the issues, but... You know, I've got some purpose and focus now.
When we make these decisions that we're going to commit ourselves to making a difference in the life of one person every single day, But what happens is that we actually build a whole generation of citizen leaders.
Greitens started The Mission Continues along with a couple of friends using his combat and their disability pay. He could have chosen a higher paying career. He's a Rhodes Scholar, has a PhD from Oxford, and has authored two books.
I believe that for all of us to have a good life, we have to live with a combination of courage and compassion. And I also believe that for all of us to have a good life, we have to live for something that is larger than ourselves.
Every generation of Americans who has fought, every generation of Americans who has served, has suffered.
Greitens is no stranger to public service. He's done humanitarian work in Cambodia, Bosnia, and Rwanda. He says his religion has motivated him.
I think there are a couple of key lessons that come from Judaism that shape my life. One of them is the idea that we have a duty to repair the world, and that all of us should play a role in our lives in trying to repair the world and to make the world better for the next generation.
The world appears to be a better place for many of the vets who have gone through The Mission Continues. A study by the Center for Social Development at Washington University in St. Louis found that over 70% of fellows have furthered their education and 80% have found civilian employment.
Delta Class, Hutton, Hut! We are fellows of The Mission Continues.
We are fellows of The Mission Continues!
These folks have already once signed on the dotted line and said that they are willing and able and ready to serve. We're just saying, serve again.
The Mission Continues has now graduated over 500 fellows and plans to recruit far more of the 5 million who have served in the last 10 years. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Dallas.
Father Andrew Greeley, sociologist, author of dozens of fiction and nonfiction books, and perennial thorn in the side of the Catholic hierarchy, died this week. He was 85. Greeley was openly critical of the church on many issues, including birth control, child sex abuse, and the status of women. 5 years ago, he suffered a traumatic brain injury after an accident. He never regained full cognitive function. In 2011, Judy Valente spent time with Greeley's family.
At a mass celebrating his 50th anniversary in the priesthood, Greeley, who said he had wanted to be a priest ever since the second grade, reflected on the controversies he had sparked.
He said, "I'm sorry for anything that I have done to people. You know, I'm not sorry for what I did in the name of people, in the name of helping people, in the name of challenging people, but I'm sorry for any relationships that were hurt."
After the accident, family and friends wondered, would he ever again be able to say the Mass, which meant so much to him? Last year, with his family around him, Greeley helped celebrate Easter Mass at the home of his niece, Eileen.
"In the name, Father."
"Does he have moments of grace, times when he flourishes? Yes, definitely. When he interacts with his family and with his friends, when he is still able to be a priest.
By the Spirit that is within us. Grant that through our Lord Jesus Christ."
"Can you bless them now?"
"The priest is still there."
"Okay."
"All those years of being a priest, all those years of blessing, they're still there, they're still connecting. And we don't know what it all means, but we know that he's blessing. And we know that he is blessed, and he's blessing us. And means love."
"The Lord be with you."
"And also with you."
"And may God bless you, Father, Son,
Holy Spirit."
Amen.
More evidence this week that you never know what might be in your closet. An Italian scholar from the University of Bologna announced that he's found the oldest known complete Torah scroll, dating back to the 12th century. He found it in his university's own library. More than a century ago, one of his predecessors mistakenly had cataloged the scroll as from the 17th century. On our calendar, on June 2nd, Roman Catholics celebrate the Feast of the Body and Blood of Christ, Corpus Christi, in commemoration of the Eucharist. This year, Pope Francis called for a worldwide simultaneous Eucharistic adoration, where Catholics from every time zone would be in a prayer vigil at the same time. Many around the world continue to be fascinated by the different approach Francis is bringing to the papacy. A newspaper this week published a letter the new pope wrote to a priest friend in Argentina, which offered insights into why he chose to live at a Vatican guest house rather than the apostolic palace. The 76-year-old pope said he wanted to maintain the simple way of life he had in Buenos Aires, adding, quote, "If I were to change at my age, it would certainly be ridiculous." That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, where I have a fan page, too. There's always much more on our website. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, Grammy Award-winning artist Bobby McFerrin singing Fix Me Jesus from his new CD, Spiritual. You can watch my profile of McFerrin from last week's show on our website. Fix me, Jesus. Fix me.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.